Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is acclaimed author and environmental activist Lynn Cherry. Cherry is the author and/or illustrator of over 30 books for children, including her rainforest classic, The Great Kapok Tree. She was an honoree during this year's National Women's History Month when the theme was Women Taking the Lead to Save Our Planet. Her most recent book is called How We Know What We Know About Our Changing Climate, Scientists and Kids Explore Global Warming. This was published by Dawn Publications. Cherry is currently producing a film as a companion to the book called Young Voices on Climate Change. I'm speaking to Lynn Cherry by phone from her film location in Durango, Colorado. Lynn Cherry, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you began writing environmental-themed books for children many years ago. Why are you so passionate about connecting kids to the natural world?
I think it sprung from losing my natural world when I was a kid. Like a pretty wild young thing, just going out into the woods all day and then not coming home until my mother rang the dinner bell. And then I watched that woods get destroyed. And I think that was really what formed my passion for trying to save the natural world.
Uh-huh. Where was that?
I was about 8 years old.
Uh-huh. And
it was in Pennsylvania.
Ah, I see.
Now it's under a highway.
Oh, isn't that amazing how that can... This is a good thing to try to save. Now, what sparked your idea to write the current book about climate change? Is it targeted for kids and educators primarily?
Yeah, it's called How We Know What We Know About Our Changing Climate, Scientists and Kids Explore Global Warming. It's a mouthful.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But it actually sprung from Gary Brosh's work. He's my co-author, and he's a very well-known photojournalist. And he'd been around the world photographing for Time, Discover, and Smithsonian Magazine. And especially when he went to the poles, he went to Antarctica on a National Science Foundation trip. And he just saw what was happening. And so he thought he really needed to document it. And then from those photos came his book, which is Earth Under Fire, How Global Warming is Changing the World. And when I saw the galleys for his book, I thought, this really needs to be a kid's book so that the public and kids and Congress and politicians can really understand it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not simplified, but it's a lot less dense. What we did, and actually in Gary's book, he followed around the IPCC scientists, the International Panel on Climate Change, the Nobel laureate scientists, and he followed them around as they did their studies. And so when it came to doing the kids' book, we just really had to revisit a lot of the same people and update the science.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then when we were doing the kids' book, I found all these kids who were replicating the work of the scientists, like, for instance, studying butterfly migration or bird migration or bud bursts or what's called phenology, which is tracking seasonal change. And so it just became this story about kids who were doing science and really understanding climate change because they were doing the science themselves. And then the end of the book is actually part of my favorite because it has... if you wanted to reduce your carbon footprint, how you might do that.
Yeah, I want to talk about that toward the end of the show, but let's talk a little bit more about the meat of the book. There was something fascinating to me, that historical note that you found that a school in Nova Scotia, Canada, 100 years ago, the kids were collecting data about the world around them. Talk to us about
mm-hmm.
that.
Yeah, well, a lot of the what the kids are doing is citizen science. It's kids actually taking data and understanding the world around them, and learning science hands-on. And what you're talking about, this was really amazing, that there was a group called 1,000 Eyes, and they found these ledger books that had been kept 100 years before. The superintendent of schools in Nova Scotia had every school in his jurisdiction, all the kids, every day, record what are called phenological occurrences. So it would be the first bud bursting, the first bird arriving of different species,
mm-hmm.
The first snow, the first frost, the first haying, first sheep shearing, just all these things that indicate seasonal change, which that's phenology, the study of seasonal change. And so for 26 years, he had these kids from all the schools in Nova Scotia keeping this data. And so when this group found it, they were just amazed what a treasure trove of data. you know, of information about our climate. And so then now A Thousand Eyes has this data on their website that anyone can use mm-hmm. as reference, you know, as a baseline.
God, it's amazing.
Yeah, now kids are doing it again. They're doing the same exact things again, that data collection. And they're finding, of course, what all the scientists now know, that it's getting warmer and that bird migration patterns are changing in response to this warming climate.
Mm-hmm.
And these animals are moving up mountains in response to the warming climate. And there's unequivocal correlation between these things.
Now, you've been talking to kids and writing books about kids for a long time. Has the global warming conversation made teachers get kids out to study more, or were they doing it all along?
Well, under the last administration, the EPA wasn't even allowed to talk about global climate change.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So governmental agencies weren't funding curriculum about climate change, but now everything has completely changed in the political climate and as our climate is changing. But yeah, now everyone's scrambling. You know, they're trying to play catch up to teach about climate change. And so we have a teacher guide that goes along with it that's available from Dawn Publications as well. And then I've created a couple short films, and this is a project called Young Voices on Climate Change.
Mm-hmm. I was going to bring that up, yep.
And there are success stories about kids who have reduced the carbon footprint of their homes, their schools, their communities, and in some cases even their states. So you can actually calculate how much CO2 they've prevented from going into the atmosphere by, for instance, getting a ban on school bus idling in their school and then going to the state legislature and getting a bus idling ban statewide, or banning plastic bags like these kids in Santa Monica did for the whole town.
That's so great.
Yeah, the kids know. I mean, the kids are, and they're very concerned because, you know, this is their world that they're going to inherit. But they just see it as an essential thing to be paying attention to. There's one girl in the film, she says, if you adults aren't going to do anything about global climate change, then we kids are going to take the reins. And that's the sentiment of these kids in this movie. You know, they're stepping out and they are pushing their schools and their counties and their states for legislation that's going to reduce carbon emissions. And they're going to be working on bigger things too, like trying to stop coal-fired power plants from coming online and trying to get up the CAFE standards, you know, having cars be more energy efficient. But to start, a lot of the kids are just starting with more local.
Mm-hmm. And probably in their own homes, telling their parents not to use plastic bags and maybe growing gardens. It's great that mm-hmm. there's a support for this now in this new political climate. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, all this research that you've been doing in regard to climate change, are you actually somebody who's traveling and witnessing this yourself, or are you in touch with people who are doing so?
I really relied on Gary Brosh.
Mm-hmm.
When he was writing his book, he just traveled all around the world and met the scientists, and he did all the photographs for the book except for the kids' photographs. And so when we were working on the book, I did take a couple trips. I went to Australia to meet Steve Smith, the scientist who's been studying global climate change on this mountain in the rainforest in Australia. And he had just been studying the organisms on this mountain. He wasn't really studying climate change, but then what happened is he noticed, as many scientists all around the world were noticing, that all these living creatures were moving up mountains in order to stay within the climate parameters that they need mm-hmm. in order to survive. So they were moving up the mountain. But then the ones who were already at the top of the mountain, there was no more up except heaven, you know?
Wow.
So they were just becoming extinct. And when he saw what was happening, he became so alarmed. And a lot of scientists meet at these different conferences. The same thing happened with the people who study birds. They were all at this international conference, and one after the other, they started, you know, giving these papers and saying that the birds were changing their ranges. And they were all really surprised when they found that all these studies from around the world showed that the birds were changing their ranges. And then someone said they thought that it was due to the warming climate, that they were changing in response to the warming. And so Terry Root, who's one of the scientists in the book, took all this data from all these sciences, and she crunched the numbers, and she found that it was statistically robust. In other words, there's very little doubt that this was what was causing the birds to be changing their migratory patterns. And then personally, you know, I have a farm, and I watch.
I was going to bring that up, yeah.
Uh-huh. And I just, you know, anyone who watches birds says, "What? This is amazing. This bird never was here before." You know, birds that are usually only further south are now moving north. The Baltimore Oriole is now moving north and might not even be in Baltimore in another couple of years.
Oh, that is discouraging. So do we really know that species are becoming endangered, not now from things like DDT, but is it really happening primarily from climate change, or are we still messing up the planet with chemicals and so on?
Well, we're definitely messing up the planet with chemicals, and there have been... Living Downstream is a really great book to read about that.
Yes.
Sandra Steingraber's
mm-hmm.
book.
Mm-hmm.
Her book is just fantastic.
I actually had her on the show a couple of years ago. I might have to have her on again, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Because she's done so much research on just the chemicals that are in, like, baby lotion. Or, you know, she went through her closet and after she looked up all these chemicals that were in her kids' skin lotions and things and found, oh, my God, these are dangerous substances, and mm-hmm. she tossed them all out.
Mm-hmm. But we do have, we have evidence that climate change is also endangering species, correct? It's not just
yes.
chemicals, yeah.
Oh. Yeah, oh, and the thing with chemicals is you could see we could ban chemicals, and like we banned chlorofluorocarbons, and the hole in the ozone seems to be closing up a bit now. But with climate change, there has never been this much carbon in the atmosphere in billions of years. It's really staggering, and it's very frightening.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was something like 280 parts per billion was the height of the, you know, as we're coming out of the last ice age, and now it's up to 380 parts per billion. Now, this is really very, very serious. This is why I'm devoting my whole life now to trying to educate kids about climate change, because I think kids are the perfect messenger, because they're speaking about the world they're going to inherit, and mm-hmm. I think that they can cut through a lot of the denial. Now, if there was a 90% probability that your doctor told you that, you know, you had cancer and that you should treat it, you wouldn't say, well, there's a 10% probability that I don't have it, you know, and not do anything, you know, especially, you know, if your kid was diagnosed, and here we know that there's 99% probability that climate change is what's causing all the extinctions and that it is real. Well, we need to act. And that's what these kids in the movie are saying, you know, we need to act mm-hmm. right now.
Mm-hmm.
And the climate bill that's being debated in Congress now is really rather weak. And all of us need to be calling our congresspeople and our politicians and just demanding that we say no to coal-fired power plants. If we saved all the forests, especially all the rainforests in the world, if we were to just say no more cutting of forests, and we were starting an incredible tree planting campaign, and we were able to cut off coal-fired power plants, we would be taking a huge first step to doing something about climate change. Mm-hmm. We're going to still have to live in a warmer world because that carbon's still up there. But, you know, trees suck carbon out of the air, and now there's also a lot of research on algae, and I think the government needs to be funding R&D on ways to mitigate climate change right now.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Lynn Cherry. We're talking about her latest book, How We Know What We Know About Our Changing Climate. Scientists and Kids Explore Global Warming. Now, I want to ask you this, too. What do you say to people, and there are many who still argue that there is no evidence of global warming, that there's no proof that it's man-made, but a natural progression of patterns. How do you talk to people who insist that? And many politicians still are.
You know, I just don't even engage them anymore because the science is in. All the credible scientists will tell you that climate change is real and it's happening and all the evidence is in. The evidence is in. And the people who are the naysayers are generally like, you know that Exxon had a campaign to obfuscate, to confuse people, and it was quite successful.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at those scientists who are saying that, no, they don't really believe it, just look at who they're being paid by.
Mm-hmm.
The credible scientists, the ones who are not being paid to say one way or the other. They are all in agreement that climate change is real, and that's no longer an argument. And I actually do know people who are climate deniers, and I think it's more a psychological issue.
Do you really?
Yeah, I do. They do not want to change your way of life, and they're simply not going to believe it because it's an inconvenient truth.
Speaking of an inconvenient truth, how much do you think Al Gore has helped this movement?
I just beyond belief what he's done. It's just remarkable. Mm-hmm. That movie just completely changed the dialogue. I think part of it was because he exposed the Exxon scientists.
Mm-hmm.
And it was after that movie came out that Exxon stopped funding those scientists who were just paid to confuse the issue.
Now, one of the things that you talk about in your book, which I find quite amazing, is how Alaska seems to be at the epicenter of global warming, showing up in the evidence of the growth of trees and the raising of sea levels. How come people aren't talking more about that?
Well, people are, you know, about the poles. The warming is much more pronounced at the poles, and especially the North Pole. Mm-hmm. Antarctica is... there's a little, you know, some melting, but it's nowhere near the melting that's at the North Pole. And you've seen the photographs of the icebergs and the polar bears. And the other real thing that scares me is the melting of the glaciers, because if you look at where people get their water all around the world, most of them get their water from melting snow from the mountains. And if you look at the watersheds, that's generally where it comes from. And now it's with the glaciers drying up, so is their water supply. And with the sea level rise, you're going to have a lot of people dislocated because of coastal areas being flooded. So between those two things, you're going to have massive movements of populations around the world, and it's all going to be struggling to find a place to live. So this is a really, really serious problem. But the movies that I'm making, you'll see, you can actually see them if you'd like. They're going to be on the website of Living on Earth, so that's the NPR program, so LOE.org. They're on the Alliance for Climate Education's website, that's climateeducation.org. Mm-hmm. And you could also look up Young Voices on Climate Change.com. So they're also playing right now at the American Museum of Natural History in New York City. And I think that you'll be able to see them a number of different places.
Yeah, I'm sure the word will be out. Where did you find these children to appear in this film and in your book?
The kids who are in the book, it was just the most amazing thing. I was sitting at this restaurant in Woods Hole, and I was wondering, gee, I wonder if kids can read this graph, when someone next to me said, and so I'm teaching the students how to read these graphs. It was like that.
Wow.
This kept happening, so much so that it was... it seemed almost cosmic. And I got these amazing stories just from these chance encounters with people all over the place telling me about kids, these weather rats who are studying climate and in Western Massachusetts. And they actually go on the local weather station and tell people about climate. And then a lot of the kids I found through the Earth Island Institute, which has Brower Youth Awards, and I'll take a look at this Brower Youth Award website because it's so amazing. These kids, the things that they're doing, it just makes you cry because these kids are so passionate and so creative. So they suggested that I interview Alec Lors, and he's a 14-year-old from Ventura, California. And actually, we were just out at the Telluride Film Festival. We showed the film, and Alec spoke and got a standing ovation. And he also got a standing ovation when we filmed him 2 weeks ago when he addressed the UN.
Wow.
Yeah, he's a really remarkable young man. And he started the Sea Level Awareness Project, where he put these posts around coastal Ventura that show with each degree of warming where the sea level will be. And he started Kids Versus Global Warming. And now he has a Declaration of Independence from Fossil Fuel, and he's already gotten hundreds of thousands of signatures on this. And we met with NASA scientist James Hansen, and he went over the declaration with Alec, and he signed it for my grandchildren. So we filmed him doing that.
Wow.
We filmed him yesterday with Bill McKibben, who has 350.org, the organization that's trying to galvanize people to act so that we get down to 350 parts per billion.
Now, is it educators, do you think, that are encouraging kids to get involved in these issues? How are they coming upon these passions?
Well, the kids that I've spoken to, they just saw something about global climate change on TV. I know with Alec, he went to see An Inconvenient Truth with his family. And then he said, why isn't anyone doing anything about this? I mean, this is like the whole world's going to end if we don't do something. And kids don't have those walls around them of denial. And so he just decided he was going to devote his life to try and do something about climate change. And these other kids that I've spoken to, the same thing. Their question isn't, why are we doing something? Their question is, why are you not doing something? You know, this is like life on Earth could end. Why aren't we all doing something?
Yeah.
And they're kind of confused.
And that's a good question, yeah. Now, I understand from your website that you're interested in green schools. Tell us what that means.
Well, green schools, there's a lot of things that could comprise a green school, but Gary Brosh and I actually wrote a letter that we sent to President Obama, and we were suggesting that Obama have green schools and climate and doing something about climate change as his legacy program, because they really go together nicely. Like, you have, say you have solar panels on your school, and you have the kids do energy audits. The kids are learning how to do energy audits at home and at school and in their community. And so they can come, they tell the school how they can best reduce their energy consumption. Sometimes schools have competitions where they'll try who can reduce their energy consumption the most, who can reduce the amount of garbage they produce, who can do the most recycling, you know, who can use the less water. And so all these things, plus I was so thrilled that the Obamas have a garden at the White House, because I think we should all have gardens in our backyards, because buying local is one of the best ways that you can reduce your carbon footprint. So much carbon is spent just transporting your food around, or eating no or less meat. You've probably heard now that, you know, methane is a global warming gas, and it's as serious, they say, as CO2 from automobiles. So just by eating no or less meat, you can drastically reduce your carbon footprint.
That was very encouraging to see the Obamas start that garden. What a great way to lead. Now, let's talk a little bit more about this film project. It started out as a series of small films, and you're putting it together into one whole at some point, aren't you?
Yeah, right now we have three done, and they're up on the, well, two of them are up on the websites. One of them we're still getting permissions for, because originally these were just going to be the trailers for the big film for funding purposes, and then everyone who saw them wanted them. I gave a talk at the Association of Science and Technology Museums, I mean centers, Aztec, and a lot of the museums and science centers said, oh, this would be perfect for our science centers. I'm hoping to get them in the Ithaca Science Center.
Oh, I'm sure you will be able to.
And so since there was a demand for them, I just started getting these small ones out. So now we have funding for three more of them, and we'll hopefully get them out in the next 2 months. And then we still need to get the funding for three more, and at that point we'll be weaving them into a one-hour TV special.
And
we were going to do a theatrical release, but we thought our objective really is to reach as many people as possible, and the way to do that is through TV.
And is it going to be titled Young Voices on Climate Change, or are you going to perhaps change the title at that point?
We might change it.
Okay.
Right now, it's all the shorts are part of the Young Voices on Climate Change, and it's a multimedia project, so it's going to be, you know, internet-based, and we have a website where kids can go, and it's Google-layered site, so they can go and they can find other projects in their zip code or close by, you know, and it's generally school-based, because we don't want to just have kids signing on, you know, and we think it's better to have it through a school.
Yeah, that makes sense. Now, on a personal note, you were an honoree for National Women's History Month this year. The theme was women taking the lead to save our planet. How did that feel?
Oh, I was quite surprised and flattered. I mean, to be included with some of the women that are my role models, you know, like Jane Goodall. It's an amazing list of women who have accomplished great things on that. So to be in that company, that was just wonderful.
Yeah, but it also must make you know that you're making a difference.
Well, you know what makes me realize I'm making a difference is when I run into, like, I was working on the Obama campaign, and these young people, so they're 18, 19 years old, coming up to me and saying, you know, when I was 8 years old, I didn't care about animals. I didn't know animals had feelings. I didn't think about the natural world. And then my teacher read me your book, The Great Kapok Tree.
Ah, yes.
Yeah. And then I realized animals have feelings. They need places to live. It developed empathy in me. And this is what really makes me continue on doing what I'm doing, is realizing that a book can change values. A movie can actually change values. A River Ran Wild is another one where it's about the value systems of the Native Americans, and then the colonists come and their value system is to look at nature as a set of commodities to buy and sell for profit.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it makes you realize where our value system today has brought us.
Mm-hmm.
But that values can be changed.
Yeah.
We really desperately need to change our materialistic values in this country.
Yes, we do. Yes, we do. And you are one of the voices helping to make that happen. Now, we only have about a minute left. You've been working and writing about the environment for so many, many years. Are you hopeful that we're going to save ourselves?
The reason I am is because you just look at what kids have done in the past, and these are just kids. There was this forest where I had Flute the Wood Thrush. I'd put Flute in my book, Flute's Journey.
Yeah.
And these
mm-hmm.
kids, they saved 600 acres by writing letters to the Episcopal Church. Or kids saved over 40,000 acres of rainforest. I think once kids have a place to go where they can find projects to do, find something to do to make a difference with global climate change, I think that they will all take action. And, you know, just the way kids got us to wear seat belts and recycle and stop littering. I mean, kids really have power. That's what Alec Lohr likes to say. Kids have power.
Mm-hmm.
But they do.
Yeah, they do.
They can really make their parents change the way they do things, and they can take those blinders off of the adults' eyes and make them realize that if we don't wake up and make some changes in our life, that we may lose this amazing, beautiful, diverse, wonderful world
mm-hmm.
that allows us to live.
Lynn, can you give some more contact information, how people can get in touch with you and get a hold of your book?
The books, they can just get in any bookstore or on Amazon. As far as the website, climateeducation.org is a website where they'll be able to find, kids will be able to find other kids in their area. And also, they'll be able to click on one of 10 projects that will reduce their carbon emissions and get involved. And they'll be able to click on these links and then see the films about where the kids who have done these things will be, you know, be a little 3.5-minute movie of them.
That's great. That's great. Well, Lynn Cherry, we have run out of time. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today. And good luck with your project.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. If you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation in support of the Out of Bounds radio show, please contact our fiscal sponsor, the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes, at earts.org. That's earts.org. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.